Last week, we started to get into deeper waters with an introduction to, in a way, the fundamental principle or idea or teaching that underlies the whole of Buddhism. So the fundamental teaching that encapsulates the Buddha's insight, the Buddha's insight into the nature of reality. And we started to explore what that might mean. So I gave you the bald teaching, as it were, and then we started to explore what it might mean. Can anybody remember the sort of general formula that we talked about last week? Or even what it was called? That's one of you who weren't here. Yeah, who said that? Yeah, dependent origination is one we're calling it, talking about. Conditioned reproduction is the other one. And what was, can anybody remember the gist of the formula? Formula's not quite the right word, but you know what I mean.
This being that becomes.
Yeah.
This arising that arises.
Yeah.
This not arising that does not arise.
Yeah. This not being that does not become. Yeah. So you've got some words there which sound plausible enough, but perhaps not very profound. And then what we started to do was to look at why actually they're pointing to something, a completely radical vision of what is going on in reality. And one of the things that I was trying to draw out is that if everything is just a conditioned arising and ceasing, if all there is just conditions, then our normal way of talking, which is to think in terms of things, is not the absolute truth. It's provisionally all right to think in terms of things, including this thing or me. But when you look a bit deeper, when we look a bit deeper, those things actually fall apart into this whole web of arising and ceasing, constant arising and ceasing, which doesn't have well-defined boundaries. It's not completely separate. So not only is it not fixed and still, it's not completely separate. The boundaries are not well-defined. In fact, as you look further and further out, the boundaries seem to envelop a larger and larger network of conditioned arising. So what we did last week was I got you to think about, reflect about the reasons, not the reasons, but the conditions that brought you to this evening or to this course at the London Buddhist Centre. And I was encouraging each of us to reflect on all the conditions in our lives that have led us to this point. So they could be the very immediate conditions like the London Underground, etc. Or they could be much more, in a way, meaningful things that have happened in our lives that have led us to a search for some sort of spiritual truth that has led us to Buddhism, that has led us to explore at least what's happening here at the London Buddhist Centre, to explore meditation, etc. But even if you started with the London Underground as one of the conditions that got you here, you can start working back in time, can't you? And in space, outward in space, to think of all the conditions that have to be in place for even just the London Underground to exist. But I was also encouraging us to go back in time in our own personal histories. So if our parents hadn't met, then we wouldn't be here. I often like to... I've been given this Buddhist name, Jnanavacha. But if Subhuti, the man who gave me that name, hadn't been my preceptor, well, I wouldn't be Jnanavacha. I'd be somebody else. If he hadn't found Buddhism, then I don't know quite who I would be, in a certain sense. My teacher's teacher, which is Sangharakshita, who's the founder of the order, if he hadn't found Buddhism, then none of us would be here, at least in this context. We might have found Buddhism in another context, but the London Buddhist Centre wouldn't exist. If the Buddha hadn't gained enlightenment 2,500 years ago, well, Buddhism wouldn't exist. We'd have all been Sufis or doing something else with our Wednesday evenings. Yeah? So there's a whole... I mean, that's just one strand that I'm following back in time. But actually, you could pick any condition that got you here and follow it back in time, and it would get larger and larger in its ramifications and scope. So it would not just go back in time, it would go outward into space. And one of the things I was saying last week is that you could say that it took the whole of the universe to form and unfold for this moment to arise. The fact that nearly 40 of us are gathered in this room with that whole history of conditions behind us is an arising. It's a unique arising. It's already disappearing as each moment disappears. And it's dependent, in a certain sense, on everything. Everything, in a certain sense. Yeah. So, that was a way of trying to start to broaden our minds to look at the grandeur of this perspective. It's a much, much larger, profounder perspective than our normal Western scientific materialist perspective, which is that I am a separate being, somehow plonked in this material universe with some other separate beings, and we have to either get along or compete for survival or satisfying our wants and desires. But somehow I'm isolated, alone, separate, and in this world where I have to fight for survival, or at least consume as much as I can to be happy, etc., etc. It's a very, very different perspective that has, if we let it in, profound implications for how we live our life. It turns everything around. It turns potentially everything upside down. If we don't think of ourselves as a fixed and separate entity in a world of other fixed and separate entities. Are you with me so far? That's a sort of summary of some of the things that we touched on last week. Oh, another image that we were using water as an image, weren't we? So I was using the ocean as an image for the whole of reality, whatever reality is, and the notion of whirlpools in the ocean as being condensations or crystallizations of energy in that ocean. But they're constantly moving, they're constantly forming and flowing and dancing. And what I was suggesting is that we are like different whirlpools, and everything around us is a constellation of energy that's not separate from the rest of the ocean, doesn't make sense as a separate entity apart from the ocean of existence. But nevertheless is distinguishable and has some sort of relative continuity, yeah? Even though it doesn't have an absolute defined boundary and a permanent existence, it has a relative sort of shape and continuity. And that's, in a way, what we are. We're a condensation, crystallization of energy. This is how Buddhism looks at it. That has a relative continuity. When you look a bit closer, you find that actually there's nothing essential and fixed in this being, this crystallization of energy. There's nothing static in it. And what's more, the boundaries are permeable. There's nothing hard and fast about the boundaries. There's no way of saying quite where we stop and the rest of the universe begins. It's yeah, the boundaries aren't fixed. So when we look a bit closely, things like a sense of a permanent I fall apart. Provisionally, it's fine to have a sense of self. Yeah? Provisionally, it sort of makes sense to just get through life with a sense of self. So we were drawing this distinction between an absolute truth, which says that no things, in a sense of being fixed and separate, actually exist, that there's just this flowing of conditions, and a relative truth, where we move around in a world of things, and that we get through life in that way. And Buddhism's saying that you can move around in that way. But what we do is that we misinterpret that provisional way of being for an absolute truth. So then we really do identify ourselves as a separate thing. And then we fear losing our sense of self. We fear death, which is an ultimate, perhaps, loss of self. And we fear anything in this life that threatens our identity. And we do everything we can to shore up an identity that will be happy in this world. And the whole thing, the whole process, is based on some sort of delusion that we can hold on to a sense of self. So that's what Buddhism's saying is the problem. It's not that we've just got something metaphysically awry and it's just a matter of correcting our learning. It's much, much more deeply ingrained than that. It's about how we think of ourselves in this life. And because we've got things awry, so wrong in fact, we cause ourselves and other people unnecessary pain. So that goes on to the previous week where we were talking about dukkha and unsatisfactoriness. So any questions just on that sort of recap? I'm not going to... I am going to go further, but just in terms of clarifications on that sort of recap.
Question.
Yeah.
It's not on what you said now.
Yeah.
But last week you mentioned that the universe is not random.
Did I say that?
I think it's
okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could say a bit more. So, okay, so what Buddhism's saying is that things don't arise out of nothing. They arise out of preceding conditions. And there are certain sort of, if you like, laws governing conditionality. So if you just take a plant growing, a flower growing, or, yeah, let's take a flower growing. You need a seed for the flower to grow. In a way, a seed is the condition, the main condition out of which this new plant is going to grow. But then you'd also need all the other obvious conditions of soil and water and all the rest of it. And then the plant grows, and at a certain point, it will flower. And the flower looks like it's a completely sort of different arising from the rest of the plant. But if the rest of the plant hadn't grown, the flower wouldn't have opened. Similarly, if the light hadn't shone, if there hadn't been water, if there hadn't been nutrients, if there hadn't been soil, if there hadn't been air, then the flower wouldn't have opened. So all of those conditions were necessary, but it wasn't random. It wasn't just that there was nothing and then there was a flower. It wasn't meaningless. There's a whole, in a way, set of governing laws to why a flower opens. You can't reduce it to one condition. We can't reduce it to the flower opened because of the soil, because that's not the only condition. But nor was it completely random. So it's not quite like a dot-to-dot cause and effect, but nor is it random. Now, a flower opening is perhaps still fairly easy to understand because it's in the law of Well, it's in the law of material things. It's in the realm of material things. But remember that part of what Buddhism is saying is that part of these conditions are also the mind and consciousness. And what Buddhism is saying is that consciousness and mind also follow certain laws of conditionality. In particular, there's the law of karma, which says that if we act with a mind that is metaphor and content and generous and aware, then the consequences for ourselves and others are likely to be beneficial. And if we act from greed and hatred and unawareness, they're likely to be harmful and cause more unsatisfactoriness and more pain. So in a certain sense, there's a law governing that. The karmic consequences are governed by this law of karma. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that there's no freedom in that. We can choose. We can choose whether we want to move towards metta and generosity and awareness, or whether we want to move towards more grasping. And so Buddhism's on the one hand saying it's not random, the universe isn't random, and everything that happens isn't random. On the other hand, it's not determined either. It's not predetermined. It's not that everything's fixed, and that we've got no movement or choice in that. So they're the two extremes. Either we live in a random universe, and if you had that view, then everything's meaningless. There's no point in acting in any one way or the other, because we can't control anything, and there's no direction to follow in life. That would be one extreme, and most people don't, I think, really behave as if they believe that. On the other extreme is that we live in a determined, predetermined kind of universe where there's no such thing as free action or responsibility, free will or personal responsibility. And we are really just cogs in a machine, in a vast machine, behaving in a predetermined way. And I don't think that many people act as if they believe that extreme either. And Buddhism's saying there's something else going on where there are laws of conditioning, laws of conditioned arising, but there's also choice. Does that?
Good.
I'd prefer it if it was a question.
Well, it's like a sort of half sharing, half question.
Stick to the questions for now, because I'm just aware of time and tea, and there's so many of us that I know that there's an impulse, isn't there, to want to actually share our own experiences and insights, but I want to try and keep us to time.
Well, it's very short.
Go on.
It's about making the connection you were saying about how we see ourselves as separate.
Yeah.
And so on. And one of the connections I made from coming to the LBC,
yeah,
is like, you know, I left the East and came to the West and I sort of forgot a lot of things.
Was
how closely in the Chinese culture we see that there's no separateness between what the West sees as having no life. For example, a mineral or something.
Yeah.
And we actually see that everything has an equal life.
Yeah.
So that the mineral, for example, can have a life, become a piece of wood.
Yeah.
And then becomes dust again. But it can also be inside us, you know, life and everything.
Yeah.
So we don't actually see living beings as defined as the only living things. We see everything as living.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's a really, really good point, actually. I'm glad you shared that. It brings us on to something that I'm going to talk about perhaps after our tea break, which is that not only are we not separate from a Buddhist point of view, there isn't this hard and fast distinction between consciousness and matter, or mind and body, or anything that the West has split us into. From a Buddhist perspective, mind and matter are intimately of the same stuff. there is this, if you like, and I'm using Western terms here, the Buddha wouldn't have talked in terms of, in these terms, but Sangharakshita does. He talks in terms of psychophysical energy condensing into different patterns. And from a subjective point of view, from an internal point of view, that looks like consciousness, that looks like mind. From an outer point of view, it looks like matter. It looks like the body. So, for example, we are definitely, there's aspects to us that is material. The body, yeah, is what we normally class as matter. But there's also aspects to us, from a Buddhist perspective, that aren't material, that are consciousness. And consciousness isn't reducible to matter, from a Buddhist perspective. I know some scientists think that it is, that it's just brain function. But from a Buddhist perspective, it's not. And mind and matter are, in a way, intimately part of the same stuff. So then, if that's true, everything around us, the whole world around us, is... well, there's no such thing as dead matter. There's no such thing as inert matter from this perspective. Yeah? Consciousness is intimately imbued with everything. With everything. And what we see as objects, like this bell, are just a condensation of energy in the same way that we are. And there's nothing ultimately that splits us. It's not that mind is just something, a prerogative of us. So the universe is alive in that sense, as we are alive. We're part of a living universe, not a dead one.